Alright, Jabosai, good morning. Let's begin. So today's daf is Pei Gimel, and we are starting on Pei Gimel. So we're going to start with the Mishnah. Interesting sugya today. Sakosev le'ishto dinu dvarim enli b'nechsayich. A man writes in a shtar to his wife, dinu dvarim. Now, dinu dvarim is an expression, I have nothing to do with your property. Nothing to do with your property. So what's the halacha? Hariza ocha peros pechayel. He still is able to go ahead and enjoy the benefits of the peros of her land while she's alive. The imesa yarsha, and when she dies, he ultimately inherits her. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, well, if that's the case, im kein, lama kasav la dinu dvarim enli b'nechsayeh. So we'll say, so understand what this means. A man writes, I want nothing to do with your property. And what does the Mishnah say? The Mishnah says he gets the peros. And he also inherits her when she dies, which Rabosai pretty much are his rights in her property. So what did he accomplish by writing this phrase? She'imach rabinas nakayim. Oh, what it means is that what he's telling her is that should you go ahead and sell your property during our marriage, the sale will be valid. Rabosai, meaning as opposed to, as we learned before, that a woman should not go ahead and sell property during the course of the marriage without the consent of her husband. Because in doing so, again, she does two things. Number one, she deprives him of the peros during the marriage and also goes ahead and takes away from his ability to inherit it when she dies. Or, although we saw in certain situations, he actually has the ability to take the property back after she dies. But when he makes a statement like this, what he's essentially saying is, you could do whatever you want with the property. The property is yours to go ahead and deal with. You could sell it. Fine. Next. So we'll say, now you'll see where this is going. We're building up. So let's say he says, I have nothing to do with your property or with the peros of your property. So what's the halacha? So we'll say, now in this case, not only is he said, I have nothing to do with your property, but he said, I have nothing to do with the peros of your property. So in a situation like this, again, he forfeits his rights to go ahead, bless you, he forfeits his rights to go ahead and get her peros while she's alive. The imesa yersha, but I will say, again, if she dies, he inherits her. Rabbi Huda says, the olam ochal pere peros, ad sheikh tzorvosa. Rabbi Huda comes along and says, he's able to eat pere peros, the fruits of fruits. Now we'll discuss in the Gemara, although we already alluded to this last week, what is pere peros? What is the fruits of fruits? So we'll discuss that. But Rabbi Huda says he always eats pere peros. Din udvarim ili b'nechsayich ube peros sehen ad olam. Rabbi Huda says that he eats pere peros until he writes her, I have nothing to do with your property, with your peros, and with the peros of your peros forever. When he writes that, then the maisa not only does he forfeit peros, but he also forfeits pere peros. Okay? Kasav la dinu dvarim enli b'nechsayich ube peros sehen b'chayeich u'moseich. Okay, so now he writes, I have nothing to do with your property, with your peros, with the peros of your peros, while you are alive and when you die. So what's the impact of such a statement like that? Se'ino ochal peros pechayeha. He does not eat the peros while she is alive. Ve'imesa, and if she dies, eino yarsha. He does not inherit her. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says no. Imesa yarshana, not true. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is supposed to say, even in a case like this where he says, I have nothing to do with your property, with your peros, with the peros, when you're alive and when you die. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says he still inherits her. Why? Because what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says like this, the right of a husband or the entitlement of a husband to inherit his wife is a biblical right. So because it is a biblical right, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says you can't make a t'nai that undermines that right. Because if you make such a t'nai, if you make such a t'nai, you are making a t'nai to undermine something that is a biblical reality. And whoever goes ahead and makes a t'nai on something that it says in the Torah, so the t'nai is batal. So I'll say, see, this is very interesting. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, pretty much, you can go and you can give up all of your other rights you want. But because all of those rights of Shimon Gamliel would say, are all rabbinic in nature. But lemaisa, again, when it comes to inheritance is a biblical right. So because inheritance is a biblical right, therefore, again, he cannot go ahead and undermine it with his statement, and therefore he'll still inherit her. Says the Gemara, Tanya Rabbi Chiya. Ha'omer le'ishta. Now, well, see, now, interestingly enough, Rabbi Chiya had a different version of the Mishnah. In our Mishnah, the wording is that the husband is writing to his wife, Din udvarim ein li b'nechsayich. That ultimately, again, I have nothing to do. I have nothing to do with your property. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Chiya has the version of he's not writing it, but rather, again, he's just stating it. And if you look at Rashi, Rashi is telling Rabbi Chiya Omer the Ishto, Velo Tani Kosev. Rabbi Chiya's version doesn't have that. He's writing it, Tashmo Inon, De Ba'amira Ba'ama Nami Salak Nafshe, Velo Shum Kinyinu Ksiva. And I will say, now understand, Rabbi Chiya's version is quite a chiddush. Because Rabbi Chiya is saying that a husband could even go ahead and remove his rights, even without committing anything to writing, even with just a simple verbal statement. So the Gemara says, one second, the Chi Kasav Lehachi, my Havi. But the Gemara says, one second, let's take a step back. Let's even assume he's writing it. Why should writing a statement like this of Din Udvarim Einli B'Nechsayich, why should it be impactful or meaningful at all? After all, Vahatanya, we learned, Ha'omer lechaveiro, if a person says to his friend, Din udvarim ein li asa dezu, we'll say a person says to his friend, I have nothing to do with this field. Din udvarim ein li asa dezu. Rashi says over here, Ha'omer lechaveiro, kigon sadeh shel shutfin, v'amra echa lechaveiro echa min ala shasa. We'll say, here's the case. Two people own a field jointly, two people own a field together, and one of the partners says to the other, I want nothing to do with this field. Right, I didn't dwarf in this. I have nothing to do with this field. So what's the halacha? Didn't dwarf in the asad zoo. Ainly a sekba. I have no involvement in it. The yadim is sulakes himena. My hands are removed from it. So what's the halacha? Lo amar klum. Both say such a statement is meaningless. Now, why is such a statement meaningless? Rashi says lo amar klum. De ain kan lashon matana. Because both say in order to convey ownership of something, you have to use a lashon of conveyance. And in this context, a lashon of conveyance would be a lashon of matana. So for example, if a person, let's say Reuven and Shimon own a field together, and Reuven's interested of divesting himself of his partnership interest. He has nothing to do, I have nothing to do with this field. That's nice. What does that wording even mean? You have nothing to do with this field, right? In order to be able to divest himself of his ownership interest, he has to say what? I'm sorry.
It's all for you.
I'm gifting it to you, right? Or right? Somehow I'm conveying my ownership interest to you. But just to stam say I have nothing to do with it. Such a statement like that is halachically meaningless. So if that's the case, again, Abbas, I said, this is a kasha on the Mishnah. So how could the Mishnah say, if a man goes in and says to his wife, Dinu dvarim ein li b'nechsayich, I have nothing to do with your property. So remember, Abbas, we know, even though he gets to eat peros, and even though he's going to inherit her, l'maisa, it accomplishes something. What does it accomplish? It allows her to sell the field in an unrestricted fashion, over the course of the marriage. So we see that in some way, somehow, such a statement is effective. How could it be effective? To which the Gemara says, I'll tell you. Now, what the Gemara is going to answer is, you're right. That a statement like this is only effective under certain circumstances. The Gemara now is going to now qualify those circumstances under which such a broad, ambiguous statement is effective. Amr Dibre Rabbi Yanai, oh, because save law, va'oda arusa. What's the case of Rabbosai? Where he's writing it to her when? While she is still in Arusa. Look at Rashi. Because of Oda Arusa, Vada Misha Karka Shalom, Ubalit no lechavir tzarech lo shamatana. Both say, under normal circumstances, if you own something and you want to convey ownership to someone else, you need a lashon of matana, a lashon of gift. Umas nisin bekosev la ad shalom zacha benechasim. Umas naima shalom yiska bohen lechishi yisaena. Ve itzarech lo shamatana shari ein lo achshav v'shutz. Both say, listen to this. When is he writing this statement, Din Udvarim Ein Li B'Nechsayich? He's writing it when she's in Arusa. Now what's the chap when she's in Arusa? He does not yet have any ownership interest in. Remember again, I will say a husband only gets ownership interest, or perhaps called peros interest in his wife, in his wife's property. Ultimately, once there's Nisuin. See, he's using this Lashon before they get married. Or I should say, before Nisuin. So what the Gemara is suggesting is the following, Rabosai. That when you actually acquire an ownership interest, then in order to divest yourself of that ownership interest, you have to use a proper lashon of matana, proper lashon of conveyance. But if you have not yet, if you do not yet have an ownership interest, and you're just trying to be proactive in preventing yourself from acquiring an ownership interest, then what? You could even use a much more ambiguous lashon. So the Gemara says, Kidirav Huna, Kidirav Kahana. Then Rav Kahana says, Nachala Habala Adami Makom Acher. And we'll say, if a person is going to go ahead and acquire items from a different place, a person could go ahead and make a tenai, make a condition that he not acquire it. So therefore, what Rav Kahana is saying is essentially when the husband is standing here during Erusin, so Erusin is before he acquires any ownership interest, any peros interest in the property of his wife. So because he is not yet a vested owner, even a simple, ambiguous, and superficial lashon will be enough to prevent him from acquiring certain rights. But however, again, obviously this lashon would not work when? It would not work post-Nisuin, because post-Nisuin he's already vested in the ownership interest of the peros, and therefore to divest himself of that, he would have to use the proper lashon of matana. It's very interesting. The Amar Rava, Ha'omer e'ef shi betakarnas chacham kigonzu, shomelo, because Moshe Rava says that if a person says, I don't want the benefit of a particular rabbinic enactment that was made for my benefit, I have the right to forego that rabbinic enactment, like this case. Well, so the Gemara says, "Maiki gonzu." What's the case? That they both say a person has a right to go ahead, and a woman has a right to say to her husband, "I don't want mizonos, and I'm not giving you my ma'asi adayim." So both say. So if we put this all together, really, let's work backwards. We start with the approach that a person always has the right to give up an entitlement. Right, which is logical. Entitlements are made for your benefit. Therefore, if you choose not to benefit from the benefit, that makes sense. If you choose not to benefit from this rabbinic enactment, you have every single right to say no, thank you. The paradigmatic case of that is Chazal instituted that a woman should get mizonos, but in return, she has to give her ma'asi adayim, she has to give her earnings to her husband. So if the woman says no, thank you to the mizonos, then it makes sense that she could go in and keep her ma'aseh adayim. Now that we know that, therefore Chazal granted the husband rights in the wife's property. Therefore, logic would say what? If he does not want those rights, therefore, he can give them up. That's true. Except it depends how vested. Now, again, so everyone he agrees he can give them up. The shaila is, what is the vehicle for yielding those rights? And the vehicle for yielding those rights will depend on how vested he is in those rights. So let's say, working backwards, say if it's during Erusin, he's not yet vested in those rights, because remember, we'll say a man, even though they're married, a man does not have rights in the wife's property during Erusin. Say if he has not yet been vested, acquired those rights, then even a simple lashon of Dinu Dvarim Eli B'Nechsayich, I don't want anything to do with this property, so which is a very ambiguous lashon, will work to divest him of certain future rights. However, after Nisuin, when he's already vested, he already acquires the peros, then in order for him to divest himself of certain rights, he would have to what? Use a much more clearer and much stronger lashon, a much clearer lashon of yielding those particular rights. It's just an interesting story. Therefore, again, suppose I said to bring this full circle. Therefore, when the Mishnah says, Hakosev le'ishto dinid varm elim b'nechsayich, man says, I don't want anything to do with your property. And the Gemara and the Mishnah says, what he's essentially doing is yielding his right to stop her property sales. And he's saying that you can go in and sell anything you want. So now the Gemara is qualified. When is this case in the Mishnah taking place? When is it taking place? This is during Erusin, right? So during Erusin, where before he has acquired the right, such an ambiguous Lashon rights to divest him of the right. But during Nisuin already, such a Lashon would not work. So the Gemara says, So I don't understand. If that's the case, then this should work even when she is a nesua. Meaning, if at the end of the day, this were a person could go ahead, because the Gemara seemed to go ahead and almost give the last idea that a person could give up an entitlement that is due to them. If that's the case, then he should be able to do this during Nisuin also, and even with the same ambiguous lashon. What's the issue over here? Amar Abaye nesua yado ki yada. Here's the difference, Rabbi Osei, that once a man gets married, so his hand is like her hand. Now, if you look at Rashi, Rashi says yado ki yada vahari hu kishutaf bahen. So we're going a little bit full full circle. So therefore, Abayi will say like this, once there's Nisuin, his hand is like her hand, i.e., he's really a partner in her property. If he's really a partner in her property, then Lemaisa, he needs a Lashon of Matana in order to convey rights. However, again, before Nisuin, he's not a partner in her property, and therefore even a Lashon of Din Udvarim will work just fine. Rava says, no, it's not just he's a partner, but rather what? Yado adifa miyada. In reality, his hand is even stronger than her hand. In certain aspects, and we've seen this, as much as she retains title over the property, the truth is he really does have an incredible amount of rights over the property that to a certain degree, Rava will say, makes his hand, his yad, even stronger than hers. So Rava says, so bottom line, but according to Abaye and Rava, the bottom line for our purposes is the same, which is that whenever, before Nisuin, before a husband has rights, even a Lashon of Dinu Dvarim is enough to go ahead and allow him to yield certain rights that will come to him in a property. But after Nisuin, where again he's a partner in the property, either an equal partner or a dominant partner, in order for him to go ahead and give up rights, he'd have to use a Lashon of Matan, a Lashon of gifting. But both of the Gemara asks, what does it matter? Meaning, both according to Abaye and Rava, the idea is whether his hand is like her hand or stronger than her hand, the bottom line for us is the same, which is what? For him to yield rights after Nisuin, he needs a Lashon of Matana. What's the Nafkamina? I'll tell you what the Nafkamina is. Nafkamina l'shomeres yavam. So we'll say the Nafkamina between Abaye and Rava will be in a case ultimately where she goes ahead and she's a shomeres yavam. And let's say again, if you look at Rashi, which is, we're not going to read this whole Rashi. Rashi says, Kilomar le'igin dinu dvarim lo pligi te bein yado ki yada ben yado adifem yada ein mo yala lashon dinu dvarim l'salko. So we'll remember, we've established that both Abaye and Rava, their machlokes is immaterial when it comes to the case of our Mishnah. Because both would agree that after Nisuin Lemaisa, a Lashon of Dinu Dvarim won't work. You need a Lashon of Matana. However, Plukta da Abayev Rava le'inyin Shomeres Yavam Itztarach. Ubi Vamos Ifligi ba Arbayev Rava Perakachol Is Gabi Mas Nisin Deber Dele'el Ba'isha Shomeres Yavam Shenafel Le'nechassim. So both say, the machlokes or the Nafkamina and Abayev Rava will be in the following case. If a woman is a Shomeres Yavam and she inherits property, Diktani Mesa Mayase Biksuvasa. Remember, we had this last week. So let's say the Shomeres Yavam acquires property and then she dies. Who inherits her? Ve'efliguba be'shamay u'be'silo va'oki abayi ve'pulta b'shnaflo kishi tachtov de'bal b'chayebal. So we'll say, without going through the rest of this Rashi, the Nafkamina case in Abayi and Rava would be in a situation where the Lemaisa says she inherits property while she's married, then her husband dies, then she's a Shomeres Yavam, and then she dies before Yibum is able to occur. So the Shaila is, who is entitled to the property that she inherited while she was living with her husband, and then she became a Shomeres Yavam, and then she died. So according to Rava, who says that Yado Adifa Miyada, that his hand is even stronger than her hand, then it would mean that what? That it is those who inherit the husband who ultimately, again, will inherit that property. But according to Abaye, who says that no, their hands are equal, then Lamaisa, that property may be split between the inheritors of her ksuva and the inheritors of her nechse muluk. Okay, nafkamina. But I both say, but take home message. Because again, I was talking with somebody yesterday who was very disparaging of Daf Yomi. Very disparaging of Daf Yomi. And he says, no one learns anything in Daf Yomi. I says, first of all, I think you have to ask Mechila from like 25 people who show up every single morning to come learn. But I said, you know, the Chaput Daf Yomi is, you might not remember every single detail, but there are certain yesodos that a person, that, so it made me realize I have to be more careful to just make sure to drive home certain points. So the point, the take-home message, I mean, everybody here knows the Shach Levitari about Pat anyway, I mean, don't worry about that. But he wasn't talking about other Daf Yomi Shur. But the take-home point from this piece over here is that, remember, qualifying the Mishnah's first case. Dinu Dvarim, normally, again, is a type of Lashon that does not work to divest yourself of ownership interest. This is very important. So you have two partners, leaving this case aside, two partners who own a field jointly. One of the partners wants out. One of the partners wants out. So what happens? So if the partner who wants out says, Dinu Dvarim, I'm done, I'm out, Such a lashon, of course, is inconsequential, doesn't accomplish anything. Because in order to divest yourself of an ownership interest, you have to use a lashon, ultimately, again, of conveyance. Therefore, yet the Mishnah says it does work, to which the Gemara is saying it works only during erusin. So essentially what's coming out from this sugya is, if you already own something, you have to use a lashon of matana to convey your ownership interest to someone else. But if you don't yet own something, and essentially you're trying to prevent that ownership interest from ever devolving upon you, even a simple ambiguous lashon like dinu dvarim ein li b'nechsayach, I want nothing to do with this, will be enough to go ahead and prevent the ownership interest from coming. Says the Gemara, Amar Rav Yosef, here's an interesting shayla. What happens if someone said, din udvarim ein li b'nechsayach, look at Rashi, a braisa da omer lechavero din udvarim ein li asad azuz. Listen to this. Leaving aside ksuva, Reuven and Shimon own a piece of property together. Reuven says, "Dinu dvarim ein li b'nechsayach, I don't want anything to do with this property anymore." And what happens? He does a kinyan with Shimon. So let's say a kinyan chalipin. So remember, how does kinyan chalipin work? Right. So let's say again, Reuven's trying to convey his ownership his ownership interest over to Shimon. So Shimon gives an item over to Reuven. Reuven acquires Shimon's item, and Shimon acquires Reuven's ownership interest. So even though we just said before that dinu dvarim doesn't work to convey ownership interest by itself, but what happens if you say dinu dvarim and what? And you bolster it with a kinyan. So does that work? So the Gemara says, I'm Rav Yosef, mi dinu dvarim karam yado. The only thing you've acquired through the kinyan is what? Is dinu dvarim. Which is another way of saying that what you've done is absolutely inconsequential. Right? If, you know, we'll say, if the vehicle of conveyance works, remember, kinyan is there to solidify. So if the vehicle of conveyance doesn't work, then the kinyan is not solidifying anything. Rav Nachman amar no mi gufa shel karka kana miyado. Rav Nachman says, not true. In fact, it works. He's actually acquired the actual karka. Amar Abaye, mistayim milso de Rav Yosef. Now, when Rav Yosef says that this process does not work, when is that true? Ba'orer. We'll say that is only true when what? When ultimately, again, Reuven's coming along and being ma'orer. Look at Rashi. Ba'orer kishabach chaveiro zeh lahachzik pechalko miyad amar v'ira ala matana v'amar lo nasati lecha asasada v'dinu dvaram v'alma amarti lecha shlo arivimcha. So listen to this. So when do we say, so now who is qualifying this, I'm sorry. So this is Abaye. Abaye is saying, when do we say that Rav Yosef's shita, that the kinyan doesn't work for dinu dvarim? When is that true? Well, say that's true. Play this out. Reuven says to Shimon, dinu dvarim ein li b'nechsayach, I have nothing to do with your property. And then what happens? And then they do a kinyan chalipin. Right? Remember again, so Shimon gives Reuven an item. Reuven acquires that item. By doing so, Reuven conveys his ownership over interest over to Shimon. So Rav Yosef says such an act is meaningless. So Abai says, when is that true that it's meaningless? When Shimon comes to actually take the property, right? Shimon begins putting up a fence. And Reuven says, what are you doing? When I said dinu dvarim ein li imcha, you know what I meant? I meant I don't want to fight with you, right? Dinu dvarim, I don't want to fight with you anymore, right? We're always arguing, always quarreling. I don't want to fight with you anymore. So therefore, that's when Rav Yosef says the transaction was meaningless, obviously, because Reuven is saying, I didn't mean to convey ownership interest to you. However, again, Avaba Omeid, but Rav Yosef, if Lamaisa, Reuven didn't say anything. Rashi says, Biyom o yomayim. He didn't say anything for a day or two after the transaction. Then the transaction stands. Amar Ameimar said, Helchasa migufa shalkarka kanu miyado. So Ameimar said, no, halach lemaisa, the way we paskin abosai is like Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman says that even though dinu dvarim by itself doesn't mean anything, but dinu dvarim accompanied by a kinyan is a meaningful way to convey ownership interests. So Amar le Rav Ashi la Meimar ba'orer o ba'omeid. So Rav Ashi said to Meimar, okay, but do you qualify that case? Is that even in a case where Reuven objected when Shimon subsequently came to take the land, Let me say it differently. When do you say that the halacha follows that it works? Is that only true, or is that true in a case even when he objected, when Reuven objected afterwards, or is it only true in a case where Reuven was silent afterwards? So lemay nafkam, you know, what does it matter? The chidur Rav Yosef, Amarlei, to which Ameimar said, lo shmiali. I never heard anything about this, but he really meant to say, kilomar, lo svirali. I don't make any kind of chilik between Omed and Ora. So we'll say halacha lemaisa. You should know what comes out of the sugya is we paskin, Raman paskin, Shulchan paskins like Rav Nachman. That even though what? That even though din udvarim by itself is not enough to convey ownership interest, except when.
When you're not vested yet.
Excellent. Erisin or any other case. Erisin is the example. Or any other case where you're not vested yet. The exception to that rule will be when din udvarim is bolstered by a kinyan. So when din udvarim is bolstered by a kinyan, apparently that is an effective way to go ahead and convey ownership, even when you are already vested. Says the Gemara, imke lama kasova. So let's remember again that this is still in the first case of the Mishnah. First case of the Mishnah was man's writing din udvarim ili b'nechsayich. So remember, what did the Mishnah paskin? He still gets the peros, right? And when she dies, he still inherits her. So remember again, the Mishnah says, if that's the case, then why did he write it? He wrote it to tell her that if she sells the property during the marriage, he's not going to object to those sales. So the Gemara says, "V'teimalei mikom mili saligas nafsheich." So why doesn't she say to him? Why can't she say to him that look, when you wrote these words, "Dinu dvarim ili b'nechsayich," you have effectively removed yourself from all parts of my property. Look at Rashi. Now the Gemara is asking a very interesting question. Let's build on this. Now that we've established again, when is he writing Dinu Dvarim Ili B'Nechsayich? When is he writing it? Erisin. So why can't she come along and say, listen, who's to say, when you wrote this ambiguous Lashon, who is to say that you only yielded your right to object to the sale of the property? Maybe you yielded what? Maybe you yielded what?
Everything.
Right? Meaning, one sec. If we're already established that this is happening during Erisin, because Erisin, you could go ahead and proactively yield an entitlement that is going to occur in the future. How do we know that he's only yielding this most basic entitlement to object to object to the sale? Maybe he's. Why can't she show up and say, "Look, you wrote. Here's the shtar. You wrote it during Erisin. And I think what that means is you don't even have peros. So she should be able to object to his usage of the property at all." Now, both saying that this next part is an amazing statement because intuitively it seems to go against everything we normally think. Except once we explain, we'll see it makes sense. Amar Abaye, I'll tell you why. Yad bala shtar al tachtona. Because both said the one who has the document has the lower hand. And at first glance, so we want to scream, that's craziness, right? We normally assume just the opposite. He who has, or she who has the shtar, always has the upper hand. But watch this. What does it mean? Yad bala shtar ala taktona. Look at Rashi. Yad bala shtar ala taktona. Kol hamotzi shtar al hamuchzak bedavar. Masha mefurash bishtar yachol letvoa alav. Vimashtar sosum moridin oso lefacho shebim mashmaos hashtar. But so this is what Rashi says. When you produce an ambiguous shtar, so because of its ambiguity, we can only assume that the shtar means, I don't know what the right way to say this, the lefachos shebemashmaos hashtar. Tell me if this makes sense. The least intrusive interpretation. So meaning, you could have an ambiguous shtar. So I'll give you the example. Shtar says, dinu dvarim ili b'nechsayich. So there are two ways you could interpret that. What are the two ways to interpret it? The least intrusive interpretation would mean that he's yielding the lowest right he has. What's the lowest right he has? To object her sale of the property. Or it could be referring to yielding the greatest schus he has, which is what? Which is peros. The problem, of course, is the shtar is ambiguous. We don't know what it means. To which the Gemara is saying, when you have an ambiguous shtar, we always interpret it in the least intrusive way possible. And that's what it means when it says, Yad bala hashtar ala tachtuna. She's coming along and she's saying, you wrote dinu dvarim ili b'nechsayich, you're even yielding peros. Now, is it possible that dinu dvarim ili b'nechsayich means you're yielding peros? Is that possible? That's what it means?
Possible.
Sure, it's definitely possible. But it's not what it says. It's ambiguous. So because it's ambiguous, again, we interpret it in the least intrusive, least invasive way possible, and therefore we only interpret it to mean that he's yielding the least of his zechuyos. What's the least of his zechuyos in this particular circumstance? One of the zechuyos he normally has is that he can block property sales. That's the right he's yielding. It's really very interesting. Right?
I assume that an ambiguous document is construed against the drafter.
Precisely.
So
correct.
That's exactly
so that's it.
Here.
That's it. it's construed against the drafter, who is the husband.
Because he could have been clear.
He could have been clear. Right. So you, if the drafter, I like that word. If the drafter is ambiguous, then the responsibility for ambiguity is on his shoulders. Right? Good, good. So Baruch Ivanta. So the legal system got something right. Good, good. So says the Gemara. So I'll say this is really interesting, and I want to tell you why it's fascinating. The reason why it's fascinating is because, remember, normally we assume that the one who holds the shtar is always in control. And that is true. That is normally true, except when the shtar is ambiguous. If you write an ambiguous shtar, then the husband is left holding the bag of ambiguity, and therefore again, lemaisa, he only yields the lowest zuchus, which in this case is the ability to block the property transfer, but still retains his peros. So the Gemara says, So I don't understand, maybe he's giving up peros, meaning maybe at the end of the day, he is still giving up peros. Look at Rashi, ve'ima mi peri, mesalik nafshe shlo yocha peros pechayeha, v'upachu shebekulam, avalem timkar shemafsit av gufa karka, sheroi liyoresh im tamos pechayeh yeh machra batu v'yishar. So now the Gemara says, okay, let's say I accept that logic. Then let's interpret the shtar in the least dramatic way possible. But Rabosei, think about this. The truth is, the greatest yielding of his husbandly right is selling of the property. Because Rabosei, remember, if she sells property, then what happens? It's gone. Lemaisa, if he yields peros, so it's true. He loses some peros now. But Lemaisa, if she predeceases him, then what happens? He's the owner of the land. So I could advance a cogent argument. Let's say I accept the premise that when there is an ambiguous shtar, we're going to interpret that shtar with the least amount of intrusiveness. Least amount of intrusiveness. So now I would say, however, least amount of intrusiveness is say it refers to peros. Don't say that he's yielding his right to block her property sale, because again, if she sells property, he loses it forever. At least if he gives away his peros, or if he yields his peros, it's true. He may lose that right now, but when she dies, he ultimately will be the inheritor of that property.
He doesn't have that yet. It's during Erison, right? He doesn't have it.
But he's yielding things that he will. He doesn't have peros now either. He doesn't have anything now. Right? Remember, he's writing this now, but he's giving up rights that he will have. So we're trying to figure out, like, what is the ladder of rights, what is the lowest rung that he's willing to give up? So the Gemara assumes that the lowest rung is the ability to block property sales. Gemara says, no, that's not the lowest rung. The lowest rung is peros. Because if you allow her to sell property, he's going to lose that property forever. Meaning, I must remember, if a woman predeceases her husband, and assuming she brought in a lot of property to the marriage, he stands to become a very wealthy man. Because he inherits the title to all of that property. Why would he want to give up that right? To which Rabbi said, the Gemara gives, and Rabbi said, this is an incredible yisod in life. Amra baye botsina tov mikra. Rabbi said, this is a very important yisod. A big gourd, a small gourd is better than a big gourd. You can make a bumper sticker out of that one, right? A small gourd is bigger than a... So what does that mean, Rabbi said? What does it mean a small gourd is better than a big gourd? It means, Rabbi said, there's another expression like this. What is it, what is in the hand?
A bird in the hand.
There's two in the bush. And I never really understood what that meant. What's a bush? Okay, whatever. You understand?
It's actually the opposite. That expression is the opposite of this yisod.
Why this is? Oh yeah, this yisod is that better to get what you can have now, because you don't know what's going to happen later on.
Right.
Same yisod. So what's the logical view, which makes sense. Because remember, it's true, if she goes ahead and she sells the property, so then he loses the right to inherit it. But remember, he only inherits it if she predeceases him. So first of all, who says she's going to predecease him? Number two, who knows what the value of property is going to be when she dies? So Lemaisa, again, from the husband's perspective, if he has a choice between, I mean, if you ask him, what for him is the greater entitlement? Peros, now, starting now, meaning starting, as Akiva said, Nisuin, starting a Nisuin, or some future ability to go and inherit her, so that's an easy call, right? The easy call is, certainly Peros now is a greater right. Therefore, again, if we assume that he's yielding the least of his rights, the least of the rights would be to block her ability to sell her property. The Ebbe says, and again, on all seriousness, this actually is a phrase that the Gemara uses. All you can see, the little bays there point you to different places as well. Sukkah and Temura. But again, it's an important hashkafic yisod in life as well. that botzina tov mikra, you know, sometimes people give up short-term opportunities because they're planning for something big. Now, sometimes that's important. Sometimes you have to let go of certain opportunities in the present because you're working towards something bigger. But make sure that that which you're working towards that is bigger is actually attainable. Because sometimes people have their eye on some type of future goal that may or may not be attainable. And in the interim, they give up so many beautiful opportunities in the present. Ve'ema mirusha. So maybe he's giving up his right to inheritor. I mean, we always give up a right to inheritor. To which he wants to listen to this. Amar Abaye, misa shchicha, mechira lo shchicha. Rabbi said, this is actually very interesting. So the Gemara says, no, he's not going to give up his right to inheritor. You know why? Death is common. Property sales are not as common. You know, Rabbi said, now understand what this means. So what are you talking about? Property sales are common. Rabbi said, understand, this property is talking about what kind of property? This is Nichsei Malug. Where does her Nichsei Malug come from? From her father's home. We've already spoken about this concept of Shevach Beis Aviha, this idea that by definition a woman is attached to property that her father gave her as her nadin, as her nadunya, as her dowry. So as such, the Gemara is saying is, the fact that she'll die, that she may die, and she may predecease him and he will inherit her, that's Shchiach. Therefore, he's not going to give up that right. The right that ultimately she's going to sell her property, the truth is the Gemara seems to feel in the context of a marriage, that was rare. That was rare that a woman would sell off property. Therefore, again, because that's lo shchiach, therefore, that's not really a right that he feels he's going to have to exercise so much anyway, blocking property sales. Therefore, he's willing to yield.
Because he knows it's going to go to his kids. If he doesn't take it, his kids will take it. His son will take it.
And therefore what?
So therefore, he doesn't care. So I'll take the pay risk now, and my kids will get the property.
Could be a second marriage.
Not if she sells it.
No, but if he doesn't, but if it's important for her to keep it in the family, he knows she's going to give it to the kids, and he'll just take the paper.
Right, first of all, who says it's his kids?
Well, you said it's a dowry.
Right, but I'm saying, but remember, dowry might not be as, right. I'm saying, remember, we want to structure this in a way where I don't have to start thinking about, well, if it's his kids or her kids, because the Gemara is just trying to like set up just like a clear framework. You're right, you could construct cases where where he wouldn't care. Yeah. But Lamaisa, there would be cases where he would care. Therefore, it's easier just to go with this approach because Lamaisa, what it's saying is in a vacuum, he's willing to yield the rights that he feels he would never really have to exercise to begin with. So the Gemara goes weiter. V'chi misalik inish nafshe mimilsa delo shchicha mimilsa de shchicha lo misalik inish nafshe. So as I said, but the Gemara says, when a person is willing to yield the right, a person is willing to yield the right for something that lamaisa is not common, but a person is not willing to yield the right for something that is common. Therefore, again, she's not really going to sell the property, therefore he's willing to yield that right. But he would not yield the right to inherit her because lamaisa, again, that's a milsa de shchicha, that is a common occurrence. Rav Ashi says, Rashi says that Lamaisa, again, when he goes ahead and he's yielding his rights in her property, it's clear that he's yielding the rights in the property, but not the peros. And when he yields the rights in her property, but it's only yielding rights when what? When it's her property, but not yielding the rights ultimately when she dies. And Lamaisa, again, he would be the inheritor. Rabbi Huda Omer li Olam hu ochal pere peros. So let's remember again, now the Gemara is commenting over here. In the case, this is the case of Kasav. Let me read you this case again. Kasav la dinu dvaram inli b'nechsayich. I have nothing to do with your property, with your peros. And then the halacha is he doesn't eat the peros while she's alive. But if she dies, he inherits her. Rabbi Huda says even though he doesn't eat peros, he still what? He still eats pere peros until he writes her dinu dvaram inli b'nechsayich o perosen pere perosen ad olam. Says the Gemara Tan Rabbanon. So we'll say, so now the Gemara spoke, the Mishnah spoke about peros and peri peros. So asks the Gemara, Elohim peros ve'elohim peru peros. So what's peros and what's peri peros? Hechnisa lo karka va'asasa peros harein peros. So we'll say, if what? If Lamaisa, she brings in property, and the property creates peros. And I'll say again, just keep a simple case. Simple Lamaisa case, where what? She brings in land, and he is eating of the peros of that land. That's called peros. Fine. Macher peros, v'lakach man karka, v'ases peros, harehein pere peros. But Rabbi said, listen to this. If Lamaisa, she brought in land, and then the property produced peros, and then they sold those peros, macher peros, v'lakach man karka, and they sold the peros, and from the proceeds of the sale of the peros, they bought land, that's called what? Lokah ben karka. And I will say, now that second land, let me be clear. She brought in land, we'll call it field A. That field A produced peros. And then what happened? They took the peros of field A and sold it and used the proceeds to buy field B. Field B then produced peros. The peros of field B, those are called what? Those are called peros. Hare and periperos. See, Bailuhu. So we'll say, so if that's the case, periperos. Ibailuhu. Ibailuhu Rabbi Huda. Periperos dafka. O dilma ad olam dafka. Now we'll say, now what the Gemara is asking is a very interesting question. So Rabbi Huda said the following. Rabbi Huda said.
The karka that they bought with the
peros. Well, the peros
also? No, that's called karka. That's called karka. It's only the peros that are produced from field B. That's called periperos. Karka can't be peros. Peros is always the product of the keren, of the principle.
Who owns the second land?
She owns the title. Anything, even monies, correct, even monies generated from peros, even monies generated from peros that go to buy other karka, that other karka is called her property, and the peros that come from field B, those are called periperos. So the Gemara says, remember, now what the Gemara is going back is the following. The Mishnah is saying like this. If he writes to her, din udvarm inli benichsayich, ube peri perosein ad olam. Right? Rabbi says, so lemaisa, again, husband is able to eat peri peros unless he writes to her, I don't want anything to do with your property, and with the peri peros ad olam, forever. So if he writes that, then he can't even get benefit from the peri peros. So says the Gemara, says Ibarilu Rabbi Huda, peri peros dafka. O dilma ad olam dafka. Now we'll say, O dilma tarvayu dafka. Now we'll say, now in order for a husband to yield his right to pere peros, so is it that he has to write pere peros? Or is that he has to write ad olam forever? Or is that he has to write pere peros ad olam? Meaning, what is the operative phrase here that ultimately results in the yielding of his pere peros? Again, is it just that he yields pere peros? Is it that he says ad olam forever? Or is it that it says pere peros ad olam? So the Gemara says, imtim salomar pere peros dafka ad olam lamli. If you want to say that it's, oh no, he yields periperos as long as he just writes periperos, then why do you have to write ad olam? Hakamashmalon keva the cuss of la periperos. What the Mishnah is going to teach me is that Rabbi say once he yields periperos, kiman the cuss of la ad olam. It's as if he wrote forever. V'imtim saloma ad olam dafka. And if you want to say that all he really needs to write is ad olam, meaning if he just wrote even dinu dvarim inli benichsayich ad olam. I don't know, that phrase by itself would go ahead and yield periperos as well. So periperos namely, hakamash malon avagav the kas of la periperos teaches us that even though he wrote periperos, e kas of la ad olam in, the only time he really yields periperos is if he writes ad olam, e lo, vim, and if he didn't write ad olam, even if he wrote periperos, he still would not yield the periperos. Vim tim salomar tarvayu dafka, tarti lamali, and if you want to say no, he only yields periperos when abosai, if he says, I'm giving up my periperos, and he writes what? Ad olam, then I'd say tzricha, because if he would have just said periperos and didn't write ad olam, hava mina periperos lo achel, I would have said periperos is what he doesn't eat. Hava pera de periperos achel. Oh, but I will say maybe the pear, peri de periperos, right? Field C. It's not so complicated, right? Field C. So she sold the peros of field B, bought field C. I would have thought that he could eat that. Therefore, again, lahaki itzrich ad olam. Therefore, ad olam tells me that what? No. Even Rabbo said the peri peros, he still can't eat. Vi'i kasav la ad olam, v'lo kasav la peri peros. And if he wouldn't have said ad olam, and he writes just peri peros, hav aminali olam ad peros koi. I would have thought that maybe it's only adafka asering peros. Lahaki itzrich peri peros. Therefore, requires peri peros. So Rabbo said, lemaisa, what comes out? So, actually, the Gemara kind of leaves this unresolved. The Gemara is not sure exactly which is the necessary verb. But what is clear is that if you write pere peros ad olam, what's your intention? Your intention is you're giving up everything. So the Gemara says, Ibailu.
According to the way it's writing the last part where it says if you write only ad olam.
Well, this is
pere peros, so pere peros, how do you know?
No, so that's why the Gemara says, therefore, the only thing we don't know. Therefore, the only thing we do know is that if you write Peire Peiros ad Olam, if you use all the Gemara's Masupak, I don't know what each one of these phrases does by itself. But here's what I do know, is that when you put them all together, what the husband is yielding is everything.
You should write both.
If you want to yield everything, you should write both. Or the truth is, the better Eitzah is, why don't you just write what you mean, right? Remember, again, I will say, we only have, I mean, Baruch Hashem, if we didn't have, you know, some guy who was writing in ambiguous terms, we wouldn't have a beautiful blot Gemara to learn. But Lamaisa, obviously, the way to resolve all of this is just be specific. I mean, this whole thing is only coming up because someone's using an ambiguous Lashon of Dinu Dvarim. So weiter. Listen to how interesting this is. So they asked the following kasha. Kasav la dinu dvarim ili b'nechsayich u b'peire peros. Maushi yocha peros. Oh, so listen to this. Let's say a guy says, guy writes, I have nothing. So writes to his wife, I have nothing to do with your property. U b'peire peros, and with the fruits of the fruit. But yeah, I will say, what didn't he mention in this phrase? Peros. In the Mishnah's case, he says, I have nothing to do with the peros and the peri peros. Here he's just saying, I have nothing to do with the peri peros. So does that mean that he's permitted to enjoy the peros? Mi peri peros sak nafshe, mi peri lo sak nafshe. I want him, you can say, listen, it's explicit. He's only excluding himself from the right to enjoy the peri peros. But perhaps he's still retaining the right to enjoy the peros. Oh, Dilma, mi kol mili solik nafshe. Or others say, come on, that can't mean what, I mean, it's so counterintuitive. What he's saying is, you're right, he doesn't explicitly say peros. But if he's excluding himself from peri peros, that of course means what? Everything in between. He's saying, I don't get benefit from anything. So which the Gemara says, pshita, No, it's obvious that Rabbi said, even though he didn't include Peros in that statement, when he says, I'm not getting any benefit from Peri Peros, he means from Peros and Peri Peros. Why? Listen to this, Rabbi said. Di amrit mi Peri Peros salik nafshe. Mi Peri lo salik nafshe. Because if you want to just say, he's only excluding himself from Peri Peros, but he's retaining the right to benefit from Peros. I'll tell you something very interesting. Then kevan dachlino le Peros. Peri Peros mehecho. Oh, the Gosu Dish, you're asking a very good kasha. If you want to say he's retaining the right to enjoy the peros, but he's only excluding himself from the right to enjoy the peri peros, so both say, how are there peri peros if he's eating the peros? And both say, remember again, peri peros only come up when what? When you're taking the peros, you're selling them off, you're using the proceeds to buy a field, that field's generating additional peros, that's peri peros. But if he's retaining the right to enjoy the peros, that means he's eating up the peros. If he's eating up the peros, then there's no proceeds. If there's no proceeds, there's no peri peros. To which the Gemara says, Rulatamich. But yet, using that logic, Hadistan Rabbi Huda li olamu ocha pere peros. Kevan dachlun ole pere peros mehecha. But Rabbi Huda, you can ask that same kashan Rabbi Huda in the Mishnah, where Rabbi Huda says that he eats pere peros, but I don't understand. If he's eating up all of the peros, then how are they pere peros? To which the Gemara says, ela b'tishayra. Rabbi Huda, again, remember, when a husband has rights to eat peros, it doesn't literally mean that he's sitting there and like mamish stuffing himself with every single pre that comes off the tree. The idea is that he has the rights in this, but b'pashtos, he's not consuming everything. So what does it mean, Rabbi Huda? There's always leftover peros. So therefore, again, Abosai, what the Gemara is saying over here, hachnai b'dishayir, therefore, again, you can have a case where what? You can have a case where, technically speaking, husband is entitled to peros, but yet there's still leftover peros that can be sold and could create a case of peros. So as Abosai, the Gemara's kasha still stands. Remember, so the kasha was in a case where husband just writes, din udvaran eli b'nechsayich, Ubeperi peros sehan. So here's what we know: he's asserting himself in peri peros. The shaila was. What about peros? So the Gemara says, of course peros, because we'll say if he was permitted in peros, then what? Then there's no case of peri peros. Which the Gemara says that is not true. You could have situations where he enjoys the peros, but there's still leftover peros that would allow for peri peros. Therefore, what's the halacha? So the Gemara doesn't answer. The Gemara leaves this case as a kasha, that if a man uses this ambiguous lashon of it could very well be that Lamaisa, he is still retaining his rights in the peros, but is foregoing his rights in the peri peros. Rabbi Osei Not, we'll stop over here for today. Well, let me ask Hashem, pick up at the two dots tomorrow.